something for the weekend. Good morning, it's Trina Mara, and I'm joined on the line by what I would say is Ireland's probably most famous journalist, Paul Williams. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Good morning, Trina.
How many books are we up to now at this stage, Paul?
11 for All My Sins.
Isn't that unbelievable?
11.
Was that kind of, when you got into journalism, did you think that you'd go down that road, or did you think that you'd stick to the normal journalism without bothering to do books?
Well, I don't know. I when I came to Dublin first, I came to the Sunday World in 1987. I spent over 23 years in the Sunday World. So I started getting involved in writing about crime from 87 onwards. And it was a very crime-rich environment. You had people like the Monk, you had people like the General and all those guys. The IRA were on the go, terrorizing the country. The INLA were on the go. There was all these burgeoning gangs around the place. John Gilligan was running a factory gang at the time. Georgie Mitchell, the Penguin, was one of his acolytes at the time, robbing warehouses. So it was, you sort of like grew up with them in a way. And then by the time Martin Cahill was murdered in 1994 by the IRA, I sort of said I'd put my toe into the water and try and write a book about it because I was so immersed in it. And, you know, I suppose I started the worst way possible because it was a huge success. It was number one on the bestseller list for, I think, the guts of 8 months at the time. There was a movie made out of it. And then also that year, literally within a couple of months of bringing it to the General, I did the book on the story of Phyllis Hamilton. I ghost wrote that for her. She was the, for people who don't remember, she was the former housekeeper of the celebrity priest, Father Michael Cleary, and they had a sacred relationship for many years and had two kids. And I suppose that year in 1994, 95, that was a sort of a baptism of fire. And from then on, I suppose every couple of years, I found myself writing another book about something that I was closely involved in. For example, one of the books I wrote was, you know, the murder, the whole story of the murder of Veronica Gear. And that was, as I said at the time, more personal than business. You know, that old mafia term, it's not personal, it's business. Well, for me, it was very personal. I wrote a book on Murder, Inc. about Limerick because I've been up close observer and chronicler of what was going on in Limerick for over 14 years. And I'm a good friend of many of the people who were involved in that war against the mob down there in Limerick. So, you know, there were stories that I had covered over several years that you say, well, you know, this merits a book because you're just collating all the material you've gathered and the stuff that you couldn't use in the paper and tell us a more comprehensive story on it. And
okay.
I'm glad to say that people are still sort of warm to that and still buying it in large numbers. So
yeah. When you
I'll
say,
keep going until they decide to sack me, so yeah. To speak.
When you say, Paul, you would use the material that you weren't allowed to use in the papers, were you not allowed to use it because they were afraid of being sued or they were afraid of your safety, or what was the reason some of the stuff didn't make the papers?
Be, you know, extraneous material, because in a newspaper, like, you know, I know you're a broadcast journalist, so you don't have to think about these things, but in newspapers and in the print media, you worry about space, as in the number of words in the story. So like the max on a big spread, on a long read in a newspaper, the longest you'd probably get is about 2,500 words. Like the average book I write is about 100,000 words. So you have the luxury of being able to spread out the story, give it as much space as it needs to tell every aspect of the story that you wouldn't be able to go into in detail in a newspaper.
Yeah,
that's what I mean by that.
It must have broken your heart almost that you'd had so much detail on things that you couldn't tell people. You know, you couldn't get those detail out there just because of the space element.
Well, we just had to, well, I suppose we used to get slagged off in the Sunday World years ago because after Veronica was murdered in 1996, the gangsters, the gougers around Dublin started calling it the Sunday Veronica, because every Sunday there was a front page story by me about some aspect of Veronica Gearn's murder and what Gilligan and his gang had been up to. And the reason that was, of course, as well, is that, you know, we just keep reminding the public and everything you dug up and stuff that you didn't have space for the previous week, you're going to run it the following week, because you were determined that every morsel of information you had about these guys was redistributed so the public could absorb it and understand what these guys were really like.
Paul, how do you gather the information that you need for your stories? Is there a lot of kind of knocking on doors, hoping people will talk, or how do you get the juicy detail that you need for it to be newsworthy and for it to make people buy a book or a newspaper?
It's information that you gather over many years. Like, for example, this book that I have out at the moment about the Monk. Like, I've been in his shadow, so to speak, since 1987. I was amazed myself, by the way, when I was doing my own research and researching my own material that I'd done before, the amount of stuff that I had done through the years and the amount of information I collated about various aspects of crimes contemporaneously as they were going on at the time. But I had developed over the years quite a good network of, you know, informants, people who trusted you and would talk to you. And I had a lot of good access over the past number of years since the Kinnan Hutch feud broke out, you know, to people who would give you an insight. And in a way, I got a very honest insight, I believe, from associates of Jared Hutch into this whole feud and how he reacted to it and how he found himself. Like, it's a biography about him and his life. So it was important, even though he didn't speak to me directly, it was important to try and get, okay, I wanted to work out, we all know about the Kinnan Hutch feud and how horrific and savage it has been. Mm. But I wanted to know why this leader of one side, and that we all know it's a very mismatched conflagration, you couldn't really call it a feud, but more an annihilation. But I wanted to get into why Jared Hutch did what he did, why he went and organized the Regency, why he found himself, even though he'd retired and was the cleverest criminal on the block, found himself in the middle of this conflagration. And there's one scene I've recreated in the book, and it was one of the most poignant, and it was one of those moments with somebody I was interviewing. I had been with Jared Hutch on the night of the night his brother Eddie was shot dead. Now, just to recap for your listeners, the Regency Hotel attack happens on Friday, the 4th or 5th, I can't, that's straight off, got up my head, in February of 2016. That happened on Friday. On Monday evening, the Kinnahan gang struck back at Jared Hutch directly and murdered his brother Eddie. Now, that night that that happened, he met with an associate who described in detail to me what had happened, that he basically sat in the sitting room of his home in Clontarf in the dark, watching out the window like a feral creature on the run for his life. And he basically said, you know, and I recreate the dialogue of what he said that night, you know, I was retired. I'm not a godfather. I'm a father of kids. I had nothing to do with this. This is not my making. I got pulled into this, but I had no choice. I had to protect my family. And I think that was a moment when you become aware of that. You say, like, this guy had, in terms of criminality, had a glittering career. If you want to look at it from a criminal's perspective, he was the mastermind of three of the biggest cash robberies in the history of the state. He was the most successful gangster in the history of the state in that he didn't get involved wholesaling drugs. He minded his own business. He didn't go around pushing his weight around. He didn't go around killing people, even though he was associated with some of the first gangland murders in the history of the state. But he was not a big, bad criminal as we would describe the likes of the John Gilligans or some of these guys, or the Kinnahans. He was unique and unusual in that, and he had retired, and then he was pulled back into it purely by the sins of his own nephews, like particularly Gary Hutch, who was completely immersed in the Kinnahan gang. And that's what all these criminal thugs do. They all fall out amongst each other. They're all psychopaths. Gary Hutch double-crossed Kinnahan because he was paranoid about Kinnahan, because Kinnahan double-crossed everybody. Mm-hmm. And had them murdered, anybody who upset him, or anybody who proposed a threat, or anybody who might have known something he didn't want them to know. They got whacked. And Gary Hutch did some of that killing for him. And so Gary Hutch knew that he would be killed, and then he decided he would kill Daniel Kinnahan. The way of all of these gangs that we've seen and we've become so sadly so familiar with, particularly in Dublin and right across the country. And so therefore he had to go at Kinnahan. Kinnahan, they shot the wrong man. Kinnahan conducted his own investigation, placed Gary Hutch under house arrest, met Jared Hutch and said, look, unless the suspected shooter who shot this person by mistake or came to shoot Daniel Kinnahan is presented to be shot in the legs by Daniel Kinnahan in person, then Gary Hutch is going to be harmed. They did a deal. They paid $200,000. A guy presented himself in Dublin to be shot in the legs in punishment for the attempt on Daniel Kinnahan's life. And everybody moved on and thought this was grand. A year later, Kinnahan double-crossed, reneged on his deal, as you would expect them to do, because these guys are incapable of being in any way honest or to fulfill any honour or promise they make. And next thing, they killed Gary Hutch in 2015. On the same day, they went for Jared's brother, Gary's father, Patsy Hutch, at a school in Glasnevin. That would have been a horrific scene. They were going to try and kill him at the same time they killed Gary Hutch. And then ultimately, they went after Jared Hutch, the man that everybody thought was totally untouchable, and they went after him on New Year's Eve in 2015, which then, a month and 4 or 5 days later, resulted in the Regency Hotel attack, because Hutch then felt he was in a corner, that he couldn't do anything, that he was in a desperate situation, that they were going to keep coming after him. He couldn't trust them. They were going to keep coming after him to kill them. So therefore, he decided to put together this, what we would could only call this a spectacular act of narco-terrorism, where these guys go and dressed us with AK-47s. And the plan was, like a St. Valentine's Day massacre, wipe out the entire of the top tier of the Kinahan gang, which included Liam Byrne, whose brother David was shot dead, the only person shot dead that day. And of course, Daniel Kinahan and others in his clique. Gosh. They didn't get them. They only got David Byrne. And that was, instead of a spectacular, it was a spectacular failure. And the rest is history. Then the Kinahans unleashed this unprecedented, which is quite something to say in the history of gangland in Ireland here, Trina, to say that they unleashed perhaps the most savage period of violence that we have ever seen in gangland. And when you consider that and contextualize that against the likes of the Crumlin and Drimla feud, and particularly the Limerick savagery that went on for 10 years, it is quite something to say. And we know that something like, in total so far, 18 people were murdered. Now, we believe that the feud, and all the indications are that the feud has now died out and burned itself out, but that was an extraordinary body count in such a short period of time.
I was just going to say, it seems to have died down all right. Do you then get tip-offs, Paul, that something is going to maybe happen later on today from your informants and the inside information that you get?
Well, sometimes you get a tip about stuff that's coming down the line, yeah. But you have to be careful how you talk about those things. So you would, yeah. You get a call from somebody who says something's happening. Or sometimes you get a call from somebody on the other side of the tracks and say, by the way, you see that incident that happened, you should look at this guy or that guy or the other guy, you know.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you get stuff like that all the time, yeah.
Do you think the criminals enjoy being written about, Paul? Do they get a kick out of it, like they've made
not.
It? They don't want you to write about them, no?
The ones that do like being written about are complete gobshites. And they're the ones who don't deserve to be written about. No, I always make the point to people, you know, they say the word glamorizing comes up all the time. Are you glamorizing these guys by writing about them? And that's an understandable ambiguity in the minds of ordinary, decent citizens, because they are, when they read about the exploits of a major criminal, like, say, Gerard Hutch, they say, oh my God, he's glamorous. But that's more a reaction, an emotional reaction from within them, than the way these guys are portrayed. They perceive it as being in some way glamorous because they find it frightening and they find it extraordinary that people are prepared to do the things that these criminals do. But the criminals don't like it. Why then would they threaten to kill? Why would they murder? The UVF people forget that my old friend and dear friend and colleague in the Sunday World in 2001, Marty O'Hagan, was shot dead by a loyalist drug gang in Lurgan. Veronica was murdered, as everybody knows, in June 1996 by a drug gang. I spent sort of like, I think, 12, 13, 14 years with full-time police protection because of the seriousness of the threats. Other journalists, since this thing kicked off, other journalists in the Independent Group, two of them have received, which were incredible death threats. And this would all indicate, rather than being delighted about being written about, they absolutely are vehemently against it. And they decide to try and shut people up as best they can. And you have to remember, well, these are just bullies and thugs. So that's why society, which was good to see in the wake of Veronica's murder and then 20 years later the Regency and all of these cases, you know, the public do reunite and the system gets together and the Gardaí get the push behind them, both from government and from the public, and they take these guys apart. And that's what the Gardaí have done. They are the only winners, ultimately, in this tripart war between the Kinahans, the Hutches and the Gardaí. The Gardaí went in and international law enforcement went in and pulled them and tore them apart. And very spectacularly so. And in fact, I'd be very happy and very confident to say that we haven't heard the last of Daniel Kinahan yet. Daniel Kinahan may be hiding out in a desert bolt hole from justice where there are no extradition agreements, but he's a glorified prisoner. But the problem he has, and where he is, he and him and the rest of his family, is that there's a huge amount of evidence against him here and in Europe, the rest of Europe, in terms of drug trafficking, gangland violence, and running one of the biggest drug cartels and crime cartels in Europe. It's only a matter of time before our guys catch up with him and he's brought home.
Yeah.
And if he thinks he's safe where he is greatly mistaken, because politics is a dirty business, as everybody knows, but Middle Eastern politics is particularly dirty. And if he thinks that he has got the loyalty of the ruling families in the United Arab Emirates, where he and his father are ensconced with other members of the gangster, he is sorely mistaken, because at the scribble of a pen, they can, at any stage, just turn around and say, yes, he is surplus to our requirements right now. We don't like this guy being in our country. We're revoking the citizenship. We're throwing him out. and give the Garda Síochána in John O'Driscoll, assistant commissioner in charge of this investigation, give him a call in Dublin and say, by the way, John, you and the lads want to come along. You can pick their man up if you have an extradition warrant from him.
Right,
here he
okay.
is. And I'm very, very confident that Daniel Kinnan, like we saw as well, Triana, you know, this ridiculous spectacle, quite disturbing spectacle of Kinnahan building himself up to becoming a major, major power broker in international world boxing.
Boxing, yeah.
And the ambivalence of the boxing sport or the sport of boxing, the big players in that hugely lucrative business, being completely ambivalent, but also being completely disassociated or detaching themselves from reality of the truth. Admonishing anybody who dared write about Kinnahan, particularly the Irish media they targeted. But now they're being forced, because of the force of the Irish government, the Irish police and the Irish media, he has become something of a pariah, or is becoming a pariah in the boxing game, which he deserves to be, because no criminal deserves to get away with what he was trying to get away, apart from the savagery mm-hmm. and the murders and all of that, to try and get himself into a sport that decent people follow, that kids are involved in. Like, this guy has completely poisoned the whole world of amateur boxing and professional boxing by his presence, and the presence of some of his very senior associates. So I'd probably be labouring on that point, but I think that's the next chapter and the last chapter in what we call this Kinnahan Hutch feud. It will be the breaking up, the final breaking up of the Kinnahans, and the return of Daniel Kinnahan to Ireland to face justice.
The brass neck of it all, it's incredible, really. Paul, what do the family think about you doing this job? I mean, you could do a normal, safe job, but yet you choose to do this, and, you know, after everything that happened, two of your colleagues, do you not worry about your safety?
I'm not really, no. I don't go around chasing blue lights and ambulances anymore and kicking in doors or all that kind of stuff. No, you get well used to it, and the kids growing up, and, after Veronica was murdered, like, you know, the family were very supportive and said, you know, the point is that, Trine, you get into a job and you don't expect the things to happen that happen, and then they happen. But then you turn around and run away and hide. That's one of the things that really disturbed me about, and I'm from down there, like, for example, in the Quinn Industrial Holdings, Kevin Nunney being abducted and all of that. I knew all those people down there. Like, I'm from there. What really disturbed me about it was that people could use such horrific violence, or even order such horrific violence, to intimidate and threaten and scare people away from doing their legitimate jobs. You can't allow that in a democratic society, because if you do, then you don't have any society after a while. And we see too much of that at the moment. There is so much micro, like, look at one of the most disturbing incidents that happened this year. Young boy, 17 years of age. Now, a young thug in the making, and he would have probably ended up getting killed at some stage. But this young Akeem Mulready Woods, you know, a 17-year-old taken away, he's murdered, and then he's cut up into pieces, and his body is dumped around the streets of Coolock. Like, you have to ask yourself, like, Jesus Christ, that was done deliberately just to terrify people in the most atavistic, feral, primitive of ways that you wouldn't have seen in a movie about the Stone Age and the shenanigans that went on at that stage. Like, you got to stand up against that. You got to keep pushing these bastards back, and that's what the people of Drogheda did. They took to the streets. The people of Limerick took to the streets. Look what Steve Collins did, who's a very dear friend of mine down in Limerick. Remember what happened to Steve? His son, Roy, was murdered because previously he and Ryan, his other adopted son, they stood up against Wayne Dundon for having young Ryan shot in the legs because he wouldn't let his 14-year-old sister into the pub one night coming up to Christmas, this time 16 years ago, right? And Steve Collins, they tried it. That was the act of really telling Steve Collins, you are screwed. We are going to run you and grind you into the ground. And even after they murdered Roy, and everybody remembers this, only 11 years ago, like, even after they murdered Roy, Steve and his other son, Steve Jr., had to go to work every day wearing bulletproof vests under police protection for years. And, like, if people run away from these guys, if you allow them to, say, bully you and scare you away as they want to do, because that's their favorite tactic, that's all they do is intimidate and threaten people. And it's going on a vast scale across our society every day of the week, then we lose all sense of, we lose all our democracy, we lose our humanity, we lose our civility as a society. Mm. And that can't happen. I know what Steve Collins did. He led 5,000-6,000 people through the streets of Limerick to stand up to these thugs and animals. And I remember that day because I was there and I was very much involved in all of that stuff at the time. But I remember the hundreds and hundreds of people, literally, who came up to Steve and contacted Steve and apologised that they couldn't be there because they were terrified of being seen at the rally because their house would be burned out that night. Yeah. And when you look at that, when you look at that in its totality, you say, you know what, getting a bit of a death threat or a threat or a bit of intimidation over shining the light on these guys, then there is no comparison. It's a duty.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound like some kind of evangelist or anything like that, but you know, it just, when you look at those things, when you witness all those things up close and personal over so many years, and you meet so many people who have had, everybody's a different story, a unique story to tell. Everybody who has been terrorist. I remember a beautiful young woman I met many years ago, and she had been, as a girl, raped by a notorious criminal. And because he was a notorious criminal, it added to the fact she was terrified to come forward. And I was personally so personally proud of, and the highlights of my career, that I could actually, with her permission and her dad's permission, write her story, name the rapist, who was Rossi Walsh, who was widely reported. He subsequently got life in prison for it. And then he got subsequently got convicted of another rape of another child. That to me, and to see that those victims then becoming beautiful women, they got their confidence back, they could hold their heads up high, they had exorcised this evil from their lives, and he got time. You know what? When you see that, and you witness and walk along the journey with them, for example, there is no greater reward that you can get or no greater satisfaction in your job than that.
Yeah.
And then you end up going to the family weddings and you see them win their happiness and you see that you played a little bit of a role for them, a little bit of help along the way that got them over the edge, got them to the place that they're in.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's, it makes it all worthwhile. Any threat from any scumbag is worth taking if you can help somebody along the way like that.
Okay. Well, Paul, it's been brilliant chatting to you. The book is called The Monk, The Life and Crimes of Ireland's Most Enigmatic Gang Boss. Out just in time for Christmas, funnily enough, Paul.
Yeah, no, it's been out now for about 2 months. It's been doing quite well, actually. It's been selling quietly way there all the time, yeah.
Brilliant stuff.
But still, I still have a few fans out there, thank God.
Yeah, and hopefully a few more books in you as well. Are you working on another one?
It's hard work doing a book, though. I'm under pressure to do another book. Yeah, but it's hard work, though, for you. Know, people don't realise that you have to hide yourself away for months and you go through different stages. I know I certainly do. Different stages of depression and anxiety and worry and stress and, you know. But maybe I may do another one. Yeah, I don't know yet. You know, please God, I'll be still alive and healthy enough to do something.
Oh, God, don't say that. I would imagine it is a job that is very difficult to switch off from, but it's one that you're so passionate about. Paul Williams, so nice to talk to you today on the show. Thank you very much.
It's lovely talking to you as well, Trina. Thank you very, very much.